Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 388. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about temples and castles and large models of food made out of towels as we go to the island of Shikoku in Japan. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. If you were sponsoring this episode of the Amateur Traveler, we'd be talking about you right now. Before this week's interview, I do have three news stories for you. In the first one, China is now opening in the Tibet region, the world's highest airport. So don't be too surprised if you're short of breath when you get off the plane at this airport, because it's at 14,472 feet. Makes the Mile High City seem easy by comparison. In the second news story, those of you who are my age may remember when Disneyland Paris opened up and there were lots of protesters protesting the Disneyfication of Paris. Well, there are protesters back out in the streets of Paris again, protesting higher standards at Disneyland. 5,000 people turned out to say that the theme park is literally falling apart with broken rides, reheated food, and canceled shows, and they want to see it brought up to standards. How times have changed. The third news story is a little more personal. I went out to Catalina Island last weekend. Catalina Island is just off the coast of Los Angeles. I was a guest of the tourism board there, and there's a new video episode and a post about my trip out to Catalina, and really had a wonderful time there, especially, I would have to say, the sea kayaking off the coast. Just an hour ferry ride away from the traffic of Los Angeles is a very different world indeed, so check that out. You can find all three stories at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Dan from Chicago, who's come to talk to us about the island of Shikoku, Japan. Dan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. Glad to be here.
And I say the island of Shikoku, and some people may be scrambling to try and find their maps. So can you help them out? First of all, where are we talking about?
Shikoku is the fourth largest of the islands in Japan, and the island people are most familiar with probably is, it's called Honshu, and that's the island that has Tokyo and Kyoto, as well as Hiroshima. But if you go down to Hiroshima and just hop across the Seto Inland Sea, that would be where you would find Shikoku.
Okay.
So it's kind of a southwest, I would say.
And you have visited there, but you've also lived there for a while.
That's correct. Yeah, actually, my first visit to Shikoku was when I began living there as an English teacher in a city called Imabari.
Why should someone go to Shikoku?
Well, I think someone should go to Shikoku because, first off, it's a gorgeous island physically. Like the rest of Japan, you know, it is very mountainous. I think it's around like 82% of Japan is mountains. But more importantly, Shikoku is one of those islands that is kind of unlike any other place you'd probably find in Japan. It's very traditional. So if you're looking to find kind of the more path less traveled in Japan, Shikoku would definitely be the place to go. The people are quite different from those living in Tokyo and Kyoto, as far as my eyes and ears as a foreigner can detect. And there's a lot of really fascinating history, outdoor activities that you just really can't compare to in other parts of Japan, I would say.
And you say quite different.
It's a little bit difficult to articulate, but most people probably first fly into Tokyo, which is pretty much different from any other place in the world, I would say. But when you arrive in Shikoku, things are just more relaxed. It's kind of like comparing like one traveling to New York City, I would say, mm-hmm. and then going out into the countryside, and everything's just a little bit slower. Whether you're just taking a stroll down a street, things seem to be a little bit more slow, but talking to the people, everyone in Japan's quite polite, but I think especially in Shikoku, they're just a little bit extra friendly and maybe a little extra shy too, just because they don't see foreigners that often. But yeah, it's just a very, very laid back island to visit.
Yeah, you mentioned polite, and certainly I'd heard that my whole life, but having been there for the first time this year, and coming home and bowing to people because you just get in the habit and it seems like a normal thing to do, it was really hammered home for me just how true that is. So, and what kind of itinerary would you recommend for people if they're visiting Shikoku?
Okay, so first, like I said before, most people will probably fly into either Tokyo, like Narita or Haneda mm-hmm. International Airport. What you're probably going to do, unless you take the train, if you fly, you would fly into Matsuyama Airport, which is the largest city in Shikoku and the most famous. So you start off by getting into the airport in Matsuyama. Matsuyama is also a very historically rich city. So I would start in Matsuyama, and there are a number of various hotels, hostels there you can stay. Although I recommend staying with someone who's lived there, actually, because they can introduce you to friends and locals, and you can really get to kind of see that inner part of the city. And just a few blocks away from the train station, about a couple miles away from the airport, is the Matsuyama Castle. Now, I don't know a lot about the history, but the castle is, you can't miss it. It's huge, and it's surrounded by a large park as well. And so you can go up to the castle. There is a slight charge to go inside the castle, but unlike other castles in Japan, which kind of have been like turned into a museum of a sort, the Matsuyama Castle, you can actually see a lot of interesting, it's kind of as if you were walking in the castle just several hundred years ago. They haven't changed a lot inside. There are a few TV screens here and there, but that castle really gives you an idea of what it was like to be inside of a castle several hundred years ago.
Well, and you say a castle, and having now been there and been in more than one castle, I think we need to back up a little bit here because I would have gotten the wrong mental image. So first of all, there are only, I think, 12 castles left over from the samurai period, from the feudal period of Japan. There used to be 200. And one of the reasons is they burned down because they're wood. They're not big stone structures that I pictured.
That's right, yeah. And I think the Matsuyama Castle also had burned down at some point, if my memory serves me correctly. And when it was reconstructed, I'm not sure. I think it was originally constructed in about like 1600 or so. And I think it might have been reconstructed in 1850 or so, around that time.
Which would be just at the tail end of the feudal period, the tail end of the Shogun era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. But it still looks to be in great condition. I mean, I'm sure they've done repairs over time. But mm-hmm. yeah, if you go to the top of it, you can get an incredible view of the entire city of Matsuyama. And they do have multiple ways to get up there. You can walk up there, which if you're in moderate shape, I would say that's fine. But they also have a little cable car you can take up there as well. The only thing I would say, unless you are fluent in Japanese and can read it, I don't remember there being many English signs in the castle. So you might want to bring along, you know, a guidebook perhaps. There's a lot of resources on the internet so you can learn more about the castle itself.
And where would we go next?
From the castle, it's maybe about, I would say, half a mile or so. It's probably the most famous attraction in Matsuyama, I would say, which would be the Dogo Onsen, or hot spring.
Hot springs, right.
This hot spring is actually, if you've seen the movie Spirited Away, I hear it's the hot spring that was used to model kind of the bathhouse in the movie Spirited Away, which the whole story revolves around this really large bathhouse with all these interesting creatures, characters in there. So the hot spring itself, I actually haven't been inside. People say the quality of the hot spring isn't as nice compared to other hot springs in the area, but it's more of the historical aspect of it, which is interesting. But yeah, the entire area looks like it hadn't been touched for the last like couple hundred years. They've really done a great job, I think, of just preserving that old quality about it, which is why people go there. And there are some hostels in the area that you can stay in, so you don't have to really travel far to see that.
Well, and what I was seeing that is the history of that dates back 1,000 years.
Okay, yeah, that sounds about right. It is quite old, and like I said, you can go inside it, but I think seeing it from the outside is sufficient, honestly.
Okay.
But yeah, the entire area, or the entire city, I should say, is full of things that are entitled Dogo, and then, for example, there's the Dogo train. Mm-hmm. They really are on with this whole Dogo thing. Part of the reason for that is they're proud of this author. Natsume Soseki is his name. But yeah, he was a really famous Japanese novelist. And I haven't actually read his most famous book, which is called Bochan, I believe. But there are a bunch of novels that he wrote. And that's kind of why Matsuyama is visited by a lot of Japanese, just because I think they read a lot of his novels during school. Kokoro was actually the novel I read, but Bochan is his most famous one. And so they have like Bochan-flavored candy. They have a Bochan clock in town. Like everything's Bochan. You really quickly begin to associate the word Bochan with Matsuyama just because that's kind of how they've branded their city. Every city in Japan kind of has its own, I guess, pride, whether it be food or some author, and they just really take it and seem to run with it.
Excellent.
But yeah, I would like to talk a little bit more about the city that I spent a little bit of time in, which is about a half hour, 45 minute train ride from Matsuyama. The city is called Imabari. It's a city I definitely wasn't familiar with before I lived in Japan. I did travel to Japan a couple times before I began working there. But I lived in Imabari for 2 years. And it's not a city that often comes up in guidebooks. And whether it should or not, that's up to debate. But it is a really wonderful city if you want to just feel what it's like to live in kind of a normal city that's not Tokyo or Osaka. Mm-hmm. There are many different things to see there, definitely. And it's kind of what you can see there is based off the three main industries, which or at least two, I would say, towel manufacturing. They manufacture about 60% of Japan's towels. Also export towels. And I think also some Chinese merchants have begun trying to copy that. So I think recently I heard they started to assign serial numbers to their towels to prevent those companies in China from doing such a thing. It was towel manufacturing and then shipbuilding. Those are kind of the two big industries. So like other spots in Japan that are famous for a certain item, they have a museum such as the Ramen Museum in Tokyo. Imabari has a towel museum, which I think humors most people when they hear that. They're like, are you joking? But no, they actually have a towel museum. And I don't know what images come to people's mind when they think towel museum, but the towel museum in Imabari, which I think is the only towel museum in Japan, although, you know, you never know.
I would have to say it's the only towel museum I've ever heard of. So I've been to a cotton museum, so we're not okay. Unrelated back in rural Australia. But
yeah, well, this is the only towel museum I've heard of, at least. And it looks like a massive European castle set up in the mountains, which is probably the furthest from any image people would first come to their heads when they think towel museum. But it's this large building that's up in the mountains, and it's so beautiful that people will go and get married there. They'll have their wedding receptions at the towel museum because they have a nice outdoor area with a garden. And so you go to the towel museum, and it's not just about the manufacturing process. In fact, a very small percentage is about that process. There is, when you first go in, they do show you like the machines to make the towels, and there are English captions in there as well, so it can kind of help you with that. But the majority of the towel museum is actually art that's either constructed of towels or just paintings that were made from towel designers. It's really beautiful. And they do change it up every several months, I believe, the works that they display in there. There's a zoo in there of animals that are made from cotton. There are massive like ice cream and pizza and other sculptures that are constructed from cotton as well. And they have three levels of gift shops as well and a couple nice restaurants if you're into that. So when I was living there, I came back to the United States every Christmas, but it was always easy to pick out gifts because I can just go a couple miles to the towel museum and bring home some really nice towels for people.
Funny. And I did look on the internet. It's the only towel museum I'm finding. So
is that right? Okay. That's good to know. You can't have too many of those in the world. One's I think is enough, but it really is a great attraction.
Well, and I'm trying to picture this, and I have not seen any pictures from you yet, which other people may be looking at by the time they're listening to this. I think of towel folding on cruise ships when they talk about an ice cream or vegetables made of towels, but we're talking about giant vegetables made of towels or something?
Yeah, there's part of the museum.
Almost like towel topiary or?
Yeah, there's part of the museum, which I think is a permanent exhibit, I guess. It's just comprised of different types of foods that are made from towels and cotton. I think the ice cream was about maybe like three times or maybe two times the height that I am, and I'm 6 feet.
Excellent.
That's the Towel Museum, and I do also want to mention the Towel Museum is located, it's technically part of Imabari, but it's in a small village called Asakura, which is where I taught English for 2 years. And that is a very traditional village. You still have your old traditional Japanese houses that they look like they've been up since a couple hundred years ago. So when you go to the Towel Museum, you'll inevitably pass through this village and you can get out and walk. There's some really quaint rivers in the area. And aside from the Towel Museum, there's no really historical point of interest, at least that I know about. But it's just a really nice, naturesque area to walk through. And you can hear children playing at the schools. And you can just really get a good feel for what Inaka life or country life is like when you go to visit the Towel Museum. So, yeah, I would just recommend walking a couple hours around there. And it's very relaxing and people are very friendly. They might be shocked to see a foreigner in the area. I'm sure they've seen them before just mm-hmm. because of the Towel Museum. Because I think if there is one thing about Imabari in guidebooks, it would be the Towel Museum. But yeah, you would probably take a bus or a taxi to get there. And I do recommend stopping off in that village because people are very hospitable. And again, it just gives you a side of Japan that you definitely would not be seeing if you went to Tokyo or just went to Tokyo, Osaka, or even Hiroshima. So okay. I recommend that. Now, for the people who are really into getting some exercise during their travels and just really love being outdoors, there's a massive bridge that connects Imabari with the main island. There are two bridges, actually, but the one from Imabari goes up to around Hiroshima. And it's a 60-kilometer-long bridge. I think it was only recently constructed. I think maybe in 2006, I want to say, they finished constructing that. But the great thing about this bridge is that not only can you take a bus across it or drive across it, but there also is a separate bike path that you can cross. And they have bike stations. I think there's about six stations in total. One on the Imabari side, one on the mainland side, and then there's a few in between. So one of my favorite things to do in Imabari is to, well, I had my own bicycle at the time, but you can also rent a bicycle and you can just go take an hour ride if you want, or you can take a few hours and cross the entire bridge. But the bridge passes through all these little islands, which most of them are still part of the city of Imabari. And these islands are really small. I mean, walking on the largest one would probably only take about 40 minutes to cross the entire thing. And so when you're biking across, you can get off at these little islands and just explore the island. There's probably only a couple thousand people living on each island, I think. And they have small museums on these islands. You know, each has its own local food. I don't know about each island individually so much, but I do remember there was, I think the first island you get to, there's a pirate museum that you can explore and see the history of the pirates. So that's really interesting. But yeah, the bike ride is just so beautiful because you're up on this bridge about a couple hundred feet tall, and you're just going across the sea. And I've never done anything like it in my life, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. So I highly recommend doing that if you go there.
And you mentioned local food. Mm-hmm. How would food in Shikoku, food in Imabari, how would that be different from other food that I'd get in Tokyo, and for instance, or anywhere else in Japan?
Sure. So like most cities in Japan, I think they'll have their kind of specialty as far as food goes. Mm-hmm. The famous food in Matsuyama would be called, of course, bochan.
Of course. And
bochan dango, which is kind of like a rice sweet of some sort. And so that's the specialty in Matsuyama. And you can find these once you get to the airport or the train station. They have them all around. So that's the specialty of Matsuyama. In Imabari, if you like chicken, yakitori, which means cooked bird, mm-hmm. is the big specialty in Imabari. And they have yakitori restaurants all around Imabari. And every year, they actually have a yakitori Olympics at the summer festival where all the local yakitori shops will compete with several judges and see who has the best yakitori in Imabari for the year.
You said the yakitori Olympics, and unfortunately I pictured people trying to pole vault with those little sticks. That was not going to be entirely successful. But
I don't think they do that quite, okay. But I think it's a tasting competition because they really take their food seriously in Japan. And you know, unlike a number of restaurants here, a lot of the times they'll just pick one food at a restaurant and really just go all out and perfecting the taste. With yakitori, it is all chicken, of course, but they do prepare it in different ways and you eat different parts of the chicken. I think they can prepare like a chicken heart, just pretty much all the parts of the chicken prepared in different ways. And it's really delicious. I mean, it's not something I would do like every day, of course. It's just too much meat. But yeah, you can find these yakitori shops. The only problem is in a city like this, because it doesn't cater so much to foreigners necessarily, I would recommend looking up some of these symbols. So when you walk down a street and you can see, oh, that's a yakitori restaurant. That's the symbol for a bird. And so that would be the only kind of hurdle to get over.
Now, one thing I found in Japan, despite speaking almost no Japanese, is they also had in many places the plastic food displays out so that even if you didn't know the word, you could see and recognize what they were serving. Is that similar here?
Sometimes it is, but yeah, in Imabari...
But if I see somebody with a lot of chicken on sticks, I would probably be clued in.
Well, yeah, a lot of the places in Imabari do not actually have the plastic models, which is, again, a bit of a hurdle. But what I would recommend doing, because people are very friendly there, they will definitely go out of the way to help you, and they'll be proud of doing so, in fact, is I would just ask someone. You can even just say the word yakitori. And they'll probably get the idea, and they'll either draw you a little bit of a map, or this has happened to me a number of times in Imabari and Japan in general, they will just walk you to the place. And in fact, I remember I got lost in Imabari one time, and I asked these school children, they were coming home from school at like 7 o'clock in the evening. I'm sure they were tired. I'm just wanting to get home to do their other homework, but they actually walked half an hour with me show me how to get to this restaurant. They weren't asking for anything in return. That's just part of the culture there is they will help you out like that no matter who you are. So it's a really great aspect of the culture.
I mentioned when I visited Nico, somebody who walked me to his car and then drove me to the other side of town to help me find what I was looking for. So yeah, amazing.
Yeah, and you almost will probably have to do that in this part of Japan, which might seem like an inconvenience to some people, but at the same time, you might even make a friend out of it. I've heard stories where those people have invited the guests back to their house, and by the end of the night, they happened to be participating in a local festival, riding on a horse through town, which happened to me once. So you don't know what can happen, but...
Back up just a little bit here.
Sure.
Local festivals, what is actually going to be one of my next questions, is there a good time to go there? But you're riding on horse through town for a local festival.
Yes. So festivals are a very important part of Japanese culture. And I mean, I can't speak for all of Japan, but I think most cities will have some type of festival. In Imabari, there was a summer festival which lasted for several days. I want to say at the beginning of September, maybe late August. But the festivals are great. They end with like a 3-hour-long fireworks show, which is amazing because the ones I'm used to are like half an hour or so. But aside from that, every region kind of has its own specialty at the festival. And so one of the local villages that I lived in, a friend of mine brought me to this festival, and he brought me inside his family's house where we had a little bit of dinner. And then next thing I know, he's like, come outside, come outside. I'm like, what? So we go outside, and there's a horse standing outside, and not just one horse, but there are probably like 50 horses. And then next to the horses are Buddhist priests and monks and people dressed in this like traditional like samurai armor. And I was definitely not expecting to see something like that, especially outside of this guy's like small house. Yeah, they put me up on the horse, and next thing I know, I'm just riding on this horse through town. I mean, not at a fast pace, of course, which is good because I think the horse is probably moving like 2 miles per hour, but even that felt a little bit fast for me. But yeah, I guess that was just part of their local festival, the parade of horses that go through the town. This is just something that's really unique to the area, because I think one of the reasons is they're, I mean, all of Japan is proud of their tradition, but yeah, especially in the countryside, it just really feels like it hasn't changed much since a couple hundred years ago, from what I've read.
Well, and festivals reminds me then of the times of year. What's the best time you think to go to Shikoku?
Definitely the best time of year would be probably late August or so. It'll still be a little bit humid, but not as bad as like mid-July, I would say. But yeah, that would definitely be the best time, in my opinion. Either that or in the springtime. But if you would like to catch a festival there, the best time would be in the fall, I would say, beginning of fall. I mean, they're not really connected by internet so much, but if you are interested in seeing the Imabari Festival, you can just do a Google search for Imabari Festival, and the Imabari government website will definitely have that up there, because it really is a sight to see. I mean, there are taiko drummers that come there, all these local taiko groups. You'll get to try the yakitori, of course, and it's really just an incredible experience. Everyone's wearing their traditional costumes, and it's just really a really great opportunity to get a feel for what life is like in kind of a smaller village like that.
And in the whole island, are there any notable festivals or special days?
No, well, I'm not sure about the rest of the island, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a large island, but I'm sure if you travel to the other prefectures, every village does take great pride in itself and is very active at keeping its traditions going, whether it's a type of food or a festival. One thing I would like to mention, speaking of the entire island, another big popular thing to do if you go to Shikoku, and probably if people do go to Shikoku, a popular reason to go there is because of the 88 Temple Pilgrimage, which is another thing aside from the Tao Museum that will pop up in the guidebooks. There are 88 temples that are spread out all through the island of Shikoku. Imabari, I think, has about 4 of those temples. Ehime Prefecture, which is, you know, the prefecture that Matsuyama and Imabari are in. I think there's somewhere around like 30 temples or so.
And when we talk temples in Japan, we're talking Buddhist temples.
Yes, these are Buddhist temples. The pilgrimage, the history is a little bit unclear, but most people would agree that it was started by this monk who's named Kokai. I believe it was in the 1600s where he chose 88 temples in Shikoku that have some type of significance to them. Mm-hmm. So the pilgrimage, it starts in the upper northwest prefecture in Japan, which is Tokushima. I think the first temple starts there. And then there's a specific path to take all around Shikoku. And now, traditionally, it was done by foot just because, you know, the only other option was horses, maybe if people could afford one. A lot of times today, due to just, you know, time constraints, people will drive to the temples Some will bike to the temples as well. Some people just do a few of the temples. I have not been to all 88 myself. One day I would like to do that, but...
Of the ones you've been to, are there any ones that really stand out?
As far as Buddhist temples go, a lot of them are quite similar. I mean, mm-hmm. everyone's kind of different in its own way. Just there are certain elements of them that are pretty much the same, which is why some people might just do a few of them because, I mean, as fascinating as the temples are to someone who's not used to seeing that, they can get monotonous after a while. But they do all have their own unique qualities, whether it's because it's on top of a mountain, perhaps, or... you know, you have to travel through a forest to get there. It's more of just kind of just saying you've been on the pilgrimage and just taking the journey through Shikoku, which, again, I haven't done all the 88 temples before. But you do see pilgrims coming through all the time doing that. You can kind of see who they are because they'll be wearing a white robe. That's kind of the official, they call him Ohenro-san. That's the official name for a pilgrim doing that. But yeah, it's a really great way to see Shikoku and just to have a completely different experience with that. And there's very little to worry about, I would say, as far as safety as well, because Japan is a very safe place.
Even if I've been to Japan, what's going to surprise me about Shikoku?
This might happen a little bit, maybe not so much in Tokyo, but especially in Shikoku. I would just say how relaxed it feels, how at peace you feel when you first arrive, how slow things move there. Not to say that you can't go out and kind of have an energized time at like maybe a club or a bar, perhaps. They do have those there, but everything's just very, very laid back. And aside from that, it might surprise you, understandably, how many looks you might get from people there.
Sure.
Because they are not used to foreigners. So you can walk into a grocery store there and all like 200 people in the grocery store might stop what they're doing all of a sudden, look at you out of surprise. So that would be something that's kind of different that you might not experience in many other places.
Okay. You're standing in the most beautiful spot in Shikoku. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
I would be standing on top of the Shimonami Kaido Bridge, looking at the island of Shikoku itself. You first see the city of Imabari, for example, and beyond that, it's just mountains and mountains. It's just absolutely beautiful with the sea, and that combined with just knowing that you're in a safe place with very hospitable people, I think that just goes beyond visual beauty, in my opinion. It's just this beautiful feeling of peace that you feel as well.
Okay. When you lived there, you didn't grow up there. So when did you feel closest to home and when did you feel furthest from home?
Honestly, not much was familiar there. Aside from the McDonald's, which was just a couple blocks down from my apartment, whenever I wanted a kind of familiar feeling, I would never have gone to a McDonald's before going to Japan, but that did funny. Give me a kind of familiar feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, I mean, this is one of the reasons I loved it, is that it is such just a different place as far as what you see, who you talk to. Although it was very different, you know, it's still a very comfortable place, and it really kind of becomes your home very quickly. It's very easy to get used to the hospitality there and just the polite people, I would say.
Okay. One thing that makes you laugh and say, only in Shikoku.
Only in Shikoku will you be riding your bicycle down a street and you'll cross a Japanese person and they will drop everything, look at you, point at you, and scream, Michael Jackson.
Okay, scream Michael Jackson.
That happened to me, yes.
Do you in fact look like Michael Jackson?
I look nothing like Michael Jackson, but the overall point of that is just to show how much you stand out there. In Tokyo, you know, you probably won't get that so much, but in Shikoku, you're so out of place there. That's probably something that can only happen in Shikoku, I would say.
Okay. Last two questions. I think you know what's coming. Finish this sentence. You really know you're in Shikoku when what?
You're on a city street, yet you can't hear any sounds of cars honking, and you feel the breeze passing by, and you just feel this complete feeling of solitude that you haven't really experienced anywhere else, I would say.
Okay. And if you had to summarize Shikoku in three words, what three words would you use?
Quaint.
Okay.
Traditional and serene.
Excellent. Well, Dan, thanks so much for coming on the Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your obvious love for Shikoku.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was a pleasure.
I heard from Lily this week, who is pitching me another show on the South Pole. By the way, I listened to your podcast on Antarctica this morning of the fellow who worked at McMurdo. My husband and I worked at the South Pole station this last austral summer season, and a lot of things have changed. The new station is built. The dome your guest talked about has been taken down. There's a new contractor for National Science, etc., etc. The landscape is still flat and white, though. Probably not ideal material for your podcast since it's not a realistic destination for most people. Tourists pay about $45,000 to $60,000 to get to the pole. But if you happen to be interested, just let me know. I can talk about what it's like to live and work in the South Pole and share some updated pictures. And I did turn Lily down. It does sound interesting, but I'm probably not going to go back and do another South Pole episode, at least not just yet, because I am trying to focus the show most of the time on destinations that people can go to and then throw in the occasional trip to the South Pole or pony trek in Lesotho. I heard from Robert in the Facebook community, facebook.com/amateurtraveler. And Robert wrote about the episode that we did recently on the Leeward Islands in the Caribbean. Another great episode. This is one of those trips that I wanted to do for a while, perhaps leaving from Puerto Rico and ending up in Venezuela. Being born in Cuba, I have always been curious about these small islands in the Caribbean. I look forward to the Windward Islands episode. I thought that next week could actually be that episode, but Gary and I had a scheduling difficulty and probably going to have to push that off a few weeks as we are both traveling to Ireland. He is leaving today and I am leaving on Thursday. And we'll meet up at TBEX, the Travel Blog Exchange Conference in Dublin, in about a week. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. Leave a comment on the Facebook community, as Robert did, or better yet, a comment on the episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And if you listen through iTunes, give us a rating. Unfortunately, at this time, we are only accepting 5-star ratings. As always, thanks so much for listening.